Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We have a lot in store for us today. We're going to talk with Sherry Parks and Dominique Stevenson. Sherry Parks has written the book Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. She's a former radio partner of mine back in the WJHU days and one of the most knowledgeable women I know on many subjects, and I can't wait to get the conversation started. Then we're going to have some open phones later in the hour, but right now we're going to turn this over to WEAA Traffic. And get you all home safe and sound, and then turn this over to Your Money Matters and finish the story that we started last week. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Money Matters with MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Today, we continue our discussion about payday loans, how they can put you on a treadmill to financial ruin, but how you can take control of your financial life. We'll be talking with Aziza Gray once again. Aziza, when we left off last week talking about payday loans, you were talking about how you got into this rut, that you needed money for your daughter's school and didn't want to go to the bank and or the credit union to get your money. So, but this vicious circle begins that you talked about, where you get to one payday lender and go to another one to pay off that one, then you get sucked into it deeper and deeper. Single mothers are the ones who get hit the most, and that's what you are. So what do you think the alternative is? What would have been the alternative for Aziza Gray at that very first moment, other than getting that first payday loan?
I should have went to my credit union. When the situation came to a head, I had to pull contracts and read what I signed, because you tend to just, with dealing with payday loans, you know you're getting the money. You don't read the contract. You just sign it and go. And once I pulled the contracts and read what I signed, everything fell down on me. So I ended up going to my director of my department, which at that point in time was in lending. And I put my cards out on the table. I cried for a very long time. And basically what she told me was, you know, you're an employee of the credit union. We're going to hold you to a higher standard. So we need you to do something, and then I'll come back and do whatever I can possibly can do for you. So what I ended up doing was paying off two loans by myself. Took two paychecks, paid them all off. And then credit union gave me a loan to pay off the remainder amount that I owed to the other three companies. And that's how I got out. So if I would have initially went to the credit union first and said, I need money for this reason, I'm pretty sure they would have given it to me.
Whether you go to a credit union or bank or wherever you go, so what do you do when, how do you manage that when you're a single mother, have kids or children or child, and you run up against the wall with money? What do you do? I mean, how do you make that work?
Budgeting. You have to understand what you make and what you can spend before you can have fun or buy things for your children that is not a necessity.
That's a hard lesson to learn.
It's a very, well, you know, and if you're smacked in the face with this, it's a lesson that you have no other choice but to learn. But to understand what a budget is what needs to happen. I think everybody needs to know about financial awareness, not only for you, but for your children, especially if you're a single mother. Your children get their financial habits from you. So it's your job to make sure that you're responsible in that act. And I wasn't very responsible when it came to money.
So how do you budget then? How do you do without? What do you do without?
I do without eating out, buying clothes. I would rather go to a secondhand store if I can. Activities like vacations I had to cut out on. Just no nonsense. Just spending for just ridiculous reasons. I had to bring lunch to work and breakfast to work. Things of that nature. Had to cut down on some of the things that I thought were just little things, because every little penny does count when you don't have any money. So it's just, you have to change your lifestyle. It's a lifestyle change. As losing weight or stopping smoking, getting yourself or your finances together is a whole entire lifestyle change. And it's not easy. I'm not here saying that it is. It's work. But once you get yourself to a point where you're comfortable, then it's okay to spend. You'll know what you have to spend. But just spending paycheck after paycheck is going to lead you to a payday lender or either worse situation.
You feel solvent now?
I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Well, this is very important, because, I mean, payday lenders are predators. And as you just said, it's an addiction for the one who goes in there.
Yes. It becomes very addictive.
Aziza Gray, this has been great meeting you. And thank you so much for being willing to share your story with everyone else.
Thank you again so very much for having me.
Take care. You've been listening to Your Money Matters, brought to you by MeQ. MeQ, invest in yourself, and we'll invest in you. For more information, call MeQ at 1-800-248-MECU or www.mecu.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are pleased to have this show during the course of this hour. It's just a pleasure to see an old friend who I have not seen in a long time on the phone a little bit here and there, Dr. Sherry Parks, who's an associate professor in American Studies at the University of Maryland, author of this new book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. And we're also joined in studio by Dominique Stevenson, who's director of the American Friends Service Committee, and one of the women interviewed for and featured in Fierce Angels, and has been on the show a while back before. We see that all the time because we're running the same kind of circles to make social change in America. Dominique Stevenson and Sherry Parks, welcome. Good to have you both in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And you can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. I said to you in the green room after reading this book that this is a book I can see that, because I know that you're brilliant and a serious scholar, and well, you know you are. You're a real great media analyst about our world and pop culture. But this feels like a book that started out like a scholarly venture that became very, very personal.
Well, it did. And you're very insightful, because that's exactly what happened. I was trying to explain my life. In a way, it started out personal, but it became academic in a very strong way. And I had about 300 pages of academic ease and academic language. And it didn't want to do that. And uh-huh. I would give talks, and black women would come up and say, no, I have to be able to read this book. Uh-huh. And I was talking to a former student of mine, who Craig Seymour, who wrote the biography of Luther Vandross and has a new book out now. And so the student became the master where we were having dinner. And I said, it doesn't want to be an academic book. And he said, so why is it? And I didn't have a good answer. but you're also right, because even then the memoir parts were not in there. Mm-hmm. But as I talked to more and more women and they began to share their stories, I felt dishonest if my story wasn't in there. And so that got added at the last, kind of the last moment.
And it's also, though, I mean, I guess it'd be very difficult, given the day and age we're in, not to always kind of make this kind of personal about the struggle and the perception of womanhood, especially black womanhood in America. I mean, it's become such a focal point so much in so many of our conversations, and, you know.
And I was ready. I had, you know, girded the loins for the onslaught, because people had said, you're going to get it. They're going to come after you.
That
black men were going to come after me, that black academic feminists were going to come after me. And I'm a black academic feminist, but that other ones were going to come at me, because I try to reclaim Mammy, for instance, and say that there's something in there that black women should pay attention to. And, you know, knock on wood, it hasn't happened.
Well, I think because you touched, and we'll talk about this, but we touched on the complexities of all these different pieces of our world. I mean, when you write about the sacred dark feminine and almost seeing the mammy figure there as well as the great power of the goddess figures of West Africa all fitting into that, that's a pretty radical notion.
Well, but it's one that particularly black women recognize once I say it. They go, oh, I didn't know about all of the goddesses when I started this. But once I put it down there, black women have said, oh, what? I see that now. And they are empowered by it, which is exactly what I wanted to do.
So let's talk about this for our listeners, the title of the book, Fierce Angels, and where that comes from.
We made it up.
Well, that's all I know where it came from.
There's a good story, because there's a group of black academics that I perform with. We do performance pieces. It's Patricia Williams from Columbia, and it's a number of people.
What do you mean you do performance pieces? I'll get to digress into that for a second. What do you mean you do performance pieces?
Well, we say things that we can't say in our other academic writing, and we have graphic arts. One of the artists, Stanford Carpenter at the Chicago Institute of Art, uh-huh. who used to be here, does graphics, and we write together, which can be really crazy, and we perform. And we perform as superheroes. I mean, we don't dress up, but we have an alter ego on the screen. And mine is Fierce Angel because we were. I said what I wanted to be like, and we started
calling. That's your nom de guerre, huh?
We started calling her Fierce Angel, thinking that we were going to make up another name, and then we didn't, and it stuck. And so I became Fierce Angel. And then when I wanted to look for a title of the book, I liked it, so we kept it for the book. And so that's how it came to be. So there's another entity called Fierce Angels.
I like that. That's a great story. That is a good story. But let's talk about, I mean, the why. One of the things you clearly do here is that this book is written to give more information to, I hate using this word, but to empower women.
I think it's useful here. Right? You're right. It's overused. And
it is,
and
yeah.
what I tried to do was to keep a lot of the complexity, but to write it in a way that was interesting to write. And I have a background years and decades now as a creative writer. That's what my undergraduate degree is in. And so I had to dust off that voice, which was rustier than I thought, to write the book. But it was hard, and it took a lot of revision. But I think, or at least people are telling me, that works that way, that the book works that way.
So did you two know each other before this started? Dominic,
yes.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
We had worked on a couple of things together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we met at a meeting that we'd called in our office at AFSC, really looking at how maybe a coalition of folks could come together to address some of the problems in the community.
And then we worked on the slavery campaign together. I brought some people to College Park via Dominique, and we talked on the radio about it.
Yeah.
And had gotten together socially because we like each other for a couple of times.
Yes.
And so when I was doing this, her name kept coming up into my head. And she's perfect. I mean, she's not the type of woman who goes around saying, I'm a strong black woman or I'm a fierce angel, but she fits the bill, I think, perfectly.
I'm going to go back a bit here and talk about the whole idea of the prototypical strong black woman.
Okay.
And what the roots of that are and the complexities of those roots as you write about them, both negative and positive.
Well, like I said, I started this to explain some things that were happening to me. It seemed that there was a conversation that had gone on that I hadn't been a part of, but that people were coming to me knowing already. People, black people, white people, people of all races were coming to me expecting me to take up their battles, assuming I would take up their battles. And often I was. So I had to carry some assumptions about myself, too. And I was simply trying to figure that out. One story is that a student came to me, a young white woman came to me and said, I want you to be my advisor for my master's thesis. And I said, well, you know, your topic is kind of in my area, but there's these other people. And she said, no, it has to be you. And I said, okay. And so we worked on our thesis. We finished. And on graduation day, her father, who had had a couple of drinks already, came to meet me. And he said, thank you for getting her through. And I said, no, it's her work. I'm only the midwife. It's really hers. And he said, no, it had to be you. I told her to go find a black woman. Okay. Hmm. And later that afternoon, she came back to damage control and told me the story of a black woman who had come to work for their family after her mother had become ill. And she had organized and healed their family. And then they had moved her to their factory, their small factory, where she had organized that and made things work smoothly and made them wealthy. Didn't make her wealthy, made them wealthy. And then the family began almost as a joke, but almost as a mantra saying, when you're in trouble, go find a black woman. And I had participated in this scenario, not knowing that that's what was going on, not knowing that that's what she was doing, not knowing that that's what I was doing. And I said, I have to figure this out. And that, I think, captures the complexity that here is this image of this woman who is nurturing and fierce and may be the only figure in American culture who's celebrated for that. I'm never saying black women are the only strong women. I'm simply saying she's the only celebrated figure like that. And that she is nurturing and fierce at the same time. And that captures, I think, a unique space in American culture.
And as you write about this in your book, it's being nurturing and fierce has its very powerful and positive roots and its very negative roots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a constant interplay where, as you put it in many ways, that women not sure how to play it because they're always being thrust into these places.
Well, I mean, the image is almost always co-opted for somebody else. And one of the things I want to do is simply to explain this so that black women can make choices for themselves, that they have all the information. I take my role as a public intellectual, another overused word, very seriously.
But an important
right.
role to play in the society.
And I'm not trying to make a decision for black women. I'm simply trying to lay out a very complex topic so that they know how to make their own decisions. They say, I want to do this, I don't want to do this. And if I do this, I want to be in control of it. Because part of the negative is that the image is almost always used for somebody else. She's always the smart lieutenant. She's always the helper and has very little control. And therein, I think, is some of the negativity, because black women get sick and die of stress-related diseases at a very high rate, even when they have the social resources, even when they have preventative care. And there was one study that found that black women don't even perceive themselves as being stressful, that they're so busy doing what they do, they don't take time to perceive their own stress. That means that black women die.
Stress is almost felt as a natural order of things. It's not even known as a disorder.
They don't even self-perceive it.
Right.
So black women die from stress-related diseases in part because of this role.
And when you write, you've always speak eloquently over the years about pop culture. When you write about pop culture in your book, whether it's the roles that Whoopi Goldberg played that you talk about, or the role that Aunt Jemima played in the same way. Though I mean, Whoopi Goldberg would probably hit me if she said,
"No,
but you know,
Let's talk about Mammy for a minute. There are two Mammy figures. I argue that there's the propaganda
right.
Mammy,
right,
and then there are my and Dominique's foremothers, and often we confuse the two. And I say that black people have given their foremothers over to this stereotype, because the propaganda Mammy was used to convince Southerners that they had participated in this glorious culture. And that they have been forgiven by these marvelous women who love them deeply. There's very little historical evidence that that type of woman ever lived, but that she was created. But we believe it. We believe those Depression-era movies. We believe those old stories. And we've confused the actual women who may have had a little power within the institution of slavery, but that they used it for their families and their children. And we've confused it. And African Americans, me included, have had a knee-jerk reaction. Calling a black woman a mammy is probably the worst thing that you can call a black woman. I mean, it's worse in many ways within black culture than, I don't know if I can say this on the radio,
the B
word. Right. Thank you. Because it means a slightly different thing in black culture than it does outside. But calling a black woman a mammy is extremely painful. And it's usually used against black women who have taken their power outside of the community for somebody else. Because the exact same figure in black culture is called mom. That woman who is very strong and very fierce and can create this exquisite sense of safety and nurturing at the same time. I mean, there's quotes where black women talk about growing up under this black woman. And if you think about it, a perfect parent is someone who not only can hold you in their lap to nurture you, but that lap is safe because she can back down other people. And this is very unscientific, and it's not in the book, but I have yet to meet a functional black person who doesn't have some black woman, their mother, their grandmother, the person down the street, who was in their corner. I mean, we all have that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very strong statement.
We're talking with Dr. Sherry Parks. Her book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. And we just joined in studio by Dominique Stevenson, who is a dear friend and also in this book, one of the women she interviewed for this book, who's director of the American Friends Service Committee. Here in Baltimore, and is one of the key people involved in many things, but one of those things is working in our prisons and with men and women in the prisons and the great work they do there, and with helping to free Marshal Eddie Conway, who's been incarcerated far too long. You can join us here at 410-319. How did I get that out there? 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888 to join in our discussion here. Sherry Parks' book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. And the roots of this, I mean, you, as a scholar, I mean, you spent a lot of time in the beginning of this book going into the historical root of all of this. And in, let me talk in the general sense that what you just described, again, I mean, everything is complex and has its kind of dialectic roots. Nothing is a simple linear path, you know, and in your book, nor in life, nor in your thinking. So, on the one hand, you write later in the book about West African cultures, the different cultures and nations in West Africa that were rooted around women, that men and women had their separate roles, but rooted around women. And how that was brought over here when people were brought from Africa as slaves, that came with them, that sense. But then it had the negative side because it destroyed the male culture in slavery and forced this new woman culture to take place that grew out of that. So again, it's one of those things from its very root had this very, the power and the pain.
Well, and that figure came from Europe. It actually, I found the sacred dark feminine on every continent.
Right.
But
right. Well, I was going to get to that.
Two major streams from Europe and Africa in what was called the slave coast in West Africa, where the majority of slaves came from. There are tribes where women tend to run the domestic sphere, the house, and men tend to run the village, where masculinity is serving one's village, a very different model than the European model or the European-American model. And, of course, slavery sheared off that role of the man and sent him as far away from the main house as they could get, it, most of them. Uh-huh. And it co-opted the black female role and laid that sacred dark feminine and the secular dark feminine right on the backs of black women, because they came with that same image, I mean, both in their religion and in the literature. And so, and then they co-opted it. They literally brought her into the house and had her do the same thing. And the literature of the time, the fiction of the time, more going out of the Civil War than going into it, talked about these, again, these marvelous women. At the very beginning, right after slavery, she could be tall, she could be short, she could be feisty, she could, and sometimes she could say, there's one Rena figure that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly where the young white girl says, "Do you love me?" And Rena says, "I think a lot of you, but I'm a slave. And your father has sold away all my kids except mm-hmm. for one. And so let's not talk about love," which is very different from what we think of as the mammy figure. And as we move further and further away from slavery and that realistic figure fades, that's when we begin to get that more mammy figure. And within black culture, particularly working black culture, I mean, we see women playing lots and lots and lots of roles. They say, when I ask them, it's because I have to. It's not a choice. It's not something that they did to black men. They said, if I don't do it, who will? And when I ask black men, what would happen if black women just stopped? Just stopped.
Yeah,
I actually couldn't get an answer out of them because they said, "Oh, she wouldn't do
it
that.
Would never happen.
They wouldn't do that." Right. They wouldn't. I said, "Well, what if?" That's just a man. No, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. But when I asked black women, "What would happen if you could just stop?" They said exactly the same thing. "I wouldn't do it," but they smiled. They like to imagine being able to stop. So the tension really shouldn't be between black men and black women, because the woman isn't trying to take over all of these spheres. She's just doing what she needs to do to get her children fed and keep them safe.
I'm going to open the phone to a lot of people calling in. I mean, one of the things you talk about here in this book about that is that how the European patriarchal system was one of the worst things that ever happened to black people on the planet Earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
So... we'll open the phones here. We'll explore that some more. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We have in the studio an old friend who's written a new book. She is a associate professor of American Studies at University of Maryland College Park. We were colleagues on the radio for many years back in the 90s. And she's written a book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture, Sherry Parks. And Dominique Stevenson is in the room, a woman I respect deeply for the work she does in our community. She's featured in the book. Of course, she's director of the American Friends Service Committee here in Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number. Could you, ladies, put on your headphones so we can just realize what we need to get the callers without the headphones on. Sorry. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Kyla in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Kyla. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I was just listening to the program. I'm a college student at South University. I'm a junior. And just listening to you guys talk about the book, I wanted to go out and buy the book. I hadn't heard about the book until now. And I just think it's very important that young women know they are strong women in the community, you know, not just celebrities that are standing for something. And I can't wait to buy the book and see, you know, the different women that you do have in your book, because I feel like a lot of black women don't know what kind of strength they do have, or they don't know exactly what they're standing for. And even these young girls coming out here, and, you know, they don't know their values. And I think, you know, we need more things like this other than just shaking your booty on the screen. I think it needs more. We need more black African-Americans standing for something. So thank you for writing the book. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kyla, for being part of the show.
Thank you. Well, she's right that many of the very prominent images are of women shaking their booties. And powerful women in the black community aren't supposed to talk about it. That's part of the role, is that you're not supposed to say, yes, I have power, because often, it's what we were talking about a minute ago, we have been trained to sit behind and do all the work and do much of the, have the power, but pretend that we don't. That's part of the role. And one of the things that some women are deciding to do is to say, no, I need to step up to the front and to save my culture, to save my people. Often women are not grabbing power for power's sake. But in order to do that, that's a very controversial stance. I mean, we just buried Dorothy Height. She was a master at that role of orchestrating behind the scenes and not saying, I am powerful. Anyway, could she have done more if she could? I don't know, in her time. But now black women need to know that they have this power. They need to understand it. Because if you don't understand your power, it can be co-opted. And that's what's happening.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Lance in Pasadena, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. Welcome.
Great, great. I'm so glad to be calling in after the young lady who called, because she makes the point that I wanted to make, and that is much of our culture as African Americans especially has been obliterated. So we choose popular culture as a replacement. Beyonce is not an example of the average black woman, but that's who's put out there. The example that I wanted to give is, in college, I had a professor who was an Hispanic gentleman, and he wasn't one of my favorite professors, but I still remember him today because that man had the greatest grasp upon race in America than any man I've known. And the reason being is because he was a history buff. He knew history better than he knew anything else. And that's really the key. I think that history unveils so much about race, but many of us never get to that point. And the caller that called in before, Kayla, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, she's an example of the hope that exists when we begin to learn how to learn, when we go beyond just the elementary thinking and we dig a little bit deeper, as these doctors who've written these books have done. And I just say kudos to you. Keep doing what you're doing, because we need more of this thinking. We need more of this deliberate thought instead of just the blanket thought that comes along with everyday living.
Lance, thank you so much for being part of the show. Appreciate you listening from Pasadena. And we're going to take a very brief break and come right back with our guests. I remind you, as we go to this break, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, go to www.umm.edu/heart. We'll be right back to talk about Fierce Angels, the strong black woman in American life and culture. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're here with Dr. Sherry Parks, who's Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. She's author of the new book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. She has hosted her own NPR program on TMD here in Baltimore and hosted her own program on WGHU back in the 90s with me back in that other era. She in the studio with us as well as Dominique Stevenson, who is director of American Friends Service Committee and one of the people featured in Fierce Angels. Number is 410-319-8888. Alex and Kanahai will be to your calls in just a minute. The others calling in at 410-319-8888. We talked a little bit in the very beginning. I want you just to talk before we hear why Dominique is in this book, which we're going to come to next, and then go back to the phones. Talk a bit about the sacred dark feminine and what that means.
Well, like a lot of black scholars, I thought my story would end at slavery. We often say, okay, slavery explains it. But it was very clear that both Europeans and Africans had this image at the beginning of slavery. So I had to keep going. And I end up at the beginning, at the early creation stories. And I am fascinated that particle physicists right now are saying the exact same story, that it was dark, something happened, then the world started.
Right.
And that the old story, the old mythology say the darkness was a she. And even in the Christian Genesis, and this is when I really thought I was going to get pushback from black people, because the darkness was there before the presumably male God did anything. So who made the darkness? Well, the older creation stories, because there's some that were written down before the Christian story was written down, say that the darkness was female and having lain with no one, so we've got an immaculate birth, she gives birth to the world, to the heavens, to the earth, and she contains the underworld for herself because that's where the regeneration comes. That's where death becomes birth again. And that is her primary role, is to lead people from death, decay, darkness into healing, order, however you want to define it. I found this on every continent. The Asian ones, the Australian ones. The spider goddesses of the Native Americans. I mean, she's on every continent. She is Mother Earth. And right now, and the stakes for this image are actually fairly high. So black women have to figure out whether they want to be at the table, because there are a number of groups who are reclaiming this image, and often black women are not in the room. It's been really interesting and wonderful to show these images to black women, because we don't know these images. And I actually had, there's a woman, there's the picture of the Buddha, the black Buddha, the Thai Buddha.
That you have a photograph of.
Yeah. Looks exactly like a woman I know. And she came to a talk I did at the university last week. She walked in and I held the book up and people were saying, wow. And when I showed it to her, she said, that's my nose. That's my eyes. That's mm-hmm. my. And mm-hmm. It matters who God looks like. And for black women to know the black Madonnas who are all over Europe, to see that picture of Pope John Paul II bowing before the Polish black Madonna,
right.
To see the black Buddha, to see the other goddesses whose photographs are in the book. Yes, that one, the black Thai, that's an ancient Thai image, clearly Afrocentric in the south of Thailand.
But the native people of Thailand, Burma, that's what they look like.
Right, right, because those tribes came up from Africa.
Right.
Exactly. We make God in our image, too.
Right.
That has been mind-blowing for me, and because my mom died in the process of writing this book, and I really—
You dedicate the book to her.
Yes, yes, right. Because like a lot of people, my mother was my fierce angel. I mean, she fought for me in a number of ways. And I was contemplating what I had lost— And I was thinking about this fierceness and this compassion, realizing that this love is godlike. And I had to stop. I had to stop writing for a minute. I mean, for a couple of days and saying, is this really what I'm saying? Because that's a very strong statement to say that the love of a mother, of this fierce and compassionate mother, is so important because it is godlike. But that's what's there. All I'm doing is laying out what has been done, what has been said.
What you're uncovering.
What I'm uncovering. I'm not trying to lead somebody to change their belief system. I'm just simply documenting and helping to analyze.
I want to go to the phones here, but let me very quickly talk to each other for a moment and talk about why Dominique's in this book and how this story came about.
Well, I had the joy of selecting people for that chapter in the book.
And
it's really important. And some of them are famous and some of them are not.
Right.
And I would call people up and say, I think this is you. And all of them said, you know, I think think you're right. Yeah, but even that, it was just a wonderful moment. And as we said before, I had known Dominique, and I know some of her work because she's a very busy woman, and it's hard to catch up with all that she's doing. But, I mean, her whole being is to help other people while maintaining. And what's very important, and I make this point in the book, she's extremely good at balancing her life and taking care of herself and making sure that there are people around her who love her and give her back, which is not part of the popular image because that woman doesn't have a life. And so I thought there's so many lessons that she has to teach other Black women about how to do this right, about why she does it, how she does it, and how she survives.
You want to tell us a bit about that?
First, I felt really honored to be a part of the book. There are women in there who I definitely look up to, and so it was really great to be in that book and include it with them. But I think one of the things, I never thought of myself in those terms, strong Black woman. I never thought of myself as a weak Black woman. I definitely was very steeped in a racial identity, but I think the women in my mother's family, they were fierce. They weren't always angels, but they were fierce, and sometimes they were angels. And I think that they gave me a sense of my own power. And even before coming into the work that I do, I think I felt a sense of power. I felt very comfortable. You know, I think I developed that long before I developed any type of political awareness. And I think that that was really important because with that power, I knew that family was very important and the next generation that's coming along was very important. So, you know, I really do. I don't think about this very often, but I do owe that to my mother. I owe that to her sisters. I owe that to my grandmother.
Let me return to the phones of the folks back in this conversation. We'll come back to talk to our two guests, 410-319-8888, as we talk about Fierce Angels, the Strong Black Woman in America's Life and Culture, the book by Dr. Sherry Parks and Dominique Stevenson, who is part of this book. 410-319-8888. Talk about your own Fierce Angels. We want to hear the stories right here. And Alex in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Alex, you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. Good day, all, and thank you for taking my call. I'm a firm believer that the key to our success as blacks in America is for us to return to our original identity and heritage. So my question to your guest is, because she referenced West Africa earlier, so my question is there any proof that she can provide that that those slaves were taken from West Africa?
Yes, because they were, and I mean, this isn't easy to talk about, but they were considered cargo, and those shipping records indicate that they picked the people up. The other thing that we have to be careful about is to believe the story that our cultures were decimated, because if you start knowing where to look, you'll see lots of things that have been retained over the centuries, and so we know. In both ways. We know who was taken and we know what cultural trends have remained.
I mean, you mentioned some of those in the beginning of the book, whether it's Akan or Dahomey or the many nations of West Africa.
Right. And in specific to the book, the goddesses and the Orishas that was eradicated in the United States for the most part. But the slavery, as it was practiced in the Caribbean and South America, did not eradicate the goddesses and the Orishas. And they're very much the same images.
And, you know, here in Baltimore, the I don't know why I'm blocking on the name of the graveyard that Morgan State University, Cemetery Morgan State University, is taking over and they're rebuilding in Southwest Baltimore. Why am I blocking on the name? The old African-American cemetery in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah. In Cherry Hill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, some of the graves there are what they found in the graves are actually symbols from various West African nations that were part of the burial 100 years ago, 90 years ago, that carried through.
And they found that in the New York dig, too.
Right. I mean, right.
Yeah, yeah.
410-319-8888, Kanahi, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate the topic and your panel, and thank you, Mrs. Steiner. I wanted to first make a statement just to echo the sentiment at the risk of sounding blasphemous, to echo the statement that I do believe that our first concept of God comes from our love and our relationship with our mother. I mean, if you think about it, our mother, not even necessarily our father, but for most people, the mother is, I mean, there's an undeniable connection and relationship that is fostered for the time that's in the womb. And, you know, your mother is your everything. And as you grow, you know, she helps you, that relationship helps you embrace God. And I just wanted to kind of echo that statement and say that I believe that. And I thought that that was a powerful statement that your guest had shared. My question is that I'm a father. I have a 3-year-old daughter. She's going to be 4 in November. I have a 2-year-old son who recently turned 2. And I was raised as the youngest of my mom's 3 sons. Mm-hmm. So I was the youngest. And I had no sisters. My wife does a phenomenal job. She is a business owner. She stays at home with the children. And we recently put our daughter in daycare. Mm-hmm. My question that I'm putting forth to your panel of experts, in addition to the book, starting, I think, with the book that she wrote, I'd like to kind of pick her brain about some resources that I could read as, or that she could point to as a father who's interested in raising a little girl into a beautiful, capable, unique person that she is. And I definitely want to do my best job. And I just thought that, you know, at the time, at the beginning of my fatherhood, that it would be a good opportunity to kind of start looking at resources to do my best job.
All right. Thank you so much.
In terms of books, they're not a lot of great books out there about raising black girls. The assumption is that they'll be okay, you know, that they'll survive. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's interesting that he brings it up because that's the next project. I have a 15-year-old daughter now, and looking for resources on how to bring her up, I found that I could find bits and pieces there, but most of them assumed pathologies that she's not dealing with. I mean, she's not... You know, she's not doing drugs. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, she's not going to have a baby. But what then? But there is a book, a children's book that you have to get. And I'm not making any money from this, but there's a book, and it's actually by a local author. But the title is Raising Dragons. It's a great children's book, and it's about a little black girl who is the only, and if this sounds like a Disney movie that's running now, I have a feeling that's not a coincidence. But don't sue me. The idea is that this little girl is the only one who's brave enough to raise the dragons on this island. And she and this dragon begin to have a relationship. And it's a great book for a little girl because you'll have to start searching for those great books for little black girls. And that's a great place to start. I know you can get it online. Sometimes you can get it in local bookstores, but it's Raising Dragons.
Raising Dragons.
Yeah.
We'll put that on our website. We'll try to find a link and put it there. SignUpShow.org. 410-319-8888. Bira in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, greetings.
Good evening.
Greetings. This is Bila, a still dancer, emissary of culture from the Virgin Islands. And the dance on stilts reflects everything that the author and your guest is saying in the performing art form. She talked about the breaking experience. She talks about the integrity of femininity. And I like her, even though I'm a male representing an Orisha perspective in femininity. I reference my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my godmothers, and all of them women in my life that has enriched me and has inspired me with the qualities of femininity that I have, to the point where sometimes I feel overwhelmingly intimidating to most women because of the strength of feminine characteristics in me as a man. And I think a lot of people, a lot of our people in our society nowadays, in our community, have a kind of... An ambivalent kind of experience with this, and it's turning out a homosexual perspective when they don't understand femininity and masculinity. But femininity in men is that responsibility. That's why they take care of the village. And the femininity in the woman is the complement. That's why they take care of the household. So that's why the integrity of the leadership for Obama is family. So that's one of the greatest inspiration that we have, because it's a card that was written by Kofi Tyus, an artist in D.C., a graphic artist in D.C., and it was featured by Sister Chinkwe in the Afro magazine, and it was about bringing families together, and it was on the perspective of honor for Dorothy Height and the qualities that she represents from that femininity. And I think a lot of men are intimidated by that, but they need not to be intimidated by that, because it's the same thing that's in them from their mothers. So we need to have a comprehensive understanding in these different qualities, because from Africa to America, we haven't lost it. What has happened is...
We don't have so much time, so... I was just going to finish your thought with.
Just thank her for expressing that. And if you ever have an opportunity to see the Still Dancer, then you'll see that.
Well, and he's right that if you go back to West Africa, and you can certainly see this in the Caribbean and South America, there's a much more fluid idea of gender. And actually, many South African, West African advocates are trying to get back to a pre-colonial view of what gender means. And they argue that the patriarchy that we mentioned before has been disastrous to them, too. And what's really interesting is that many of the women who are trying to get back to that pre-colonial image of the female are calling themselves the daughters of the goddess. And the women who are often more affluent, who have gained something from colonialism, are considered kind of the daughters of the queen. And so there is this movement to try to get back to this much more fluid idea of gender. And that you can actually see still operating with an African-American culture. That's why this woman has more masculine features than that Victorian white feminine ideal. I mean, she's stronger. She's fiercer. She is. And African-American men do demonstrate that idea. You know, my husband grew up doing his sister's hair. He knows how to do hair. I mean, that's not an uncommon role. So there is more fluidity, and it's wonderful if we understand it.
There's one of the things that really struck me is when you the first thing I found when I opened the book is I just opened it to the photograph when I first got the book.
Most people do.
You start a book, and then you go back to read it. Right. The photograph. But you have, and I remember this when this happened, and I remember these pictures. You have this picture of this boy being beaten by Maurice Gordon Bay and this other man because they thought this young boy was involved somehow in the killing of his son. And then the picture at the bottom is Jill Jenkins, who is the mother of the boy who was murdered, throwing her body over the young man being beaten by her husband and this other man.
Which is, and when I saw those pictures, I was struck by how much compassion. I think I'm a good person. I'm not sure I have as much compassion as she does to throw your own body. Because she was trying to stop them, and they wouldn't stop. And the only way she knew that they would stop was to throw her body on him. What's amazing about that picture is that somebody else saw the same picture. Because I looked at this, and I said, this is a sacred dark feminine. This is exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
But Sister Mary Aquine at the St. Agnes Seminary
Lovely,
for Women.
Incredible women.
Yes,
wow,
yes,
what
yes.
A woman she is.
And we're going to be doing a fundraiser in the fall together around this book for
at
them.
At the place?
Yes.
I'm going to come.
Yes, okay. well, and so, I mean, someone with a great deal more theological authority than I have.
She's an amazing woman.
Looked at the same picture and said, this is the sheltering feminine. This is the sacred dark feminine. And so she wrote a prayer service, which I found online. They actually had a physical prayer service, and then she put it online, and I found it. So I'm not the only one who's saying that the way black women are operating in their communities looks an awful lot like this ancient sacred dark feminine.
That's a very powerful connection. I mean, it struck me about all this. I mean, it's let me ask you this question about this. I've been dying to ask you since I've got this book. I mean, this is – so when you started creating this book and started studying to kind of put this book together, you didn't start at that place, did you?
No. I mean,
you didn't start at the place of the sacred dark feminine and the black Madonna and the history of that.
I worked my way back to it.
That's what I'm saying. So this is revelations to you as you
– Yes.
unearth the stuff in this book?
Well, I knew about some of the goddesses. I didn't know about the universality of the goddesses. I didn't know that they were everywhere and that people from all cultures had some element of it. I didn't understand the strength. I didn't understand, for instance, in Italian-American culture, when you're really in trouble, you go to the Black Madonna.
Right.
And that there were processions of Italian Americans in the early 20th century, and sometimes still in New Jersey, evidently they do the same thing. And when I talk to Italians about this, they say, "Oh yeah." And then when I talk to Polish people, they say, "Oh yeah, you know, I bought a Black Madonna prayer card on Michigan Avenue in Chicago." And so they understand this, but they understand that it had not been brought into the mainstream as religious practice, but it's being revered in Europe now and in the United States as immigrants come, as Caribbean groups come, as African groups come, as European immigrants come. There are many more instances of this in the United States. But Black women, and because the Black church is, and the caller said, I don't want to be blasphemous, it's a very frightening thing to say this in African-American culture because African-American culture is very Jesus-centric. But yes, I am saying that there has been, since the beginning of recorded time, a sacred and feminine figure who is very strong and who is still very revered.
That was just such one of the most powerful statements that came out of this book for me as I was reading it. I mean, just a lot of stuff I never knew. One of the things let me say a little piece of history you wrote about that really kind of shocked me. When you wrote about Lorraine Hansberry and A Raisin in the Sun and Lloyd Richards' original direction of that play, I did not know the story.
You mean that he took out parts? Lorraine Hansberry was a feminist.
No, I knew that, but I had no idea. I didn't know that part of the history of that play.
That he took out parts to make the male role, was the Sidney Poitier role,
right.
stronger. And even when he did that, when it went out on trials, the audience was still responding to the figure of Mama. He took out more. Yeah.
I knew Lloyd Richards a little bit. I was really shocked when I read that. Really kind of like, what?
And then he admits it.
And he admits it.
Yeah. Well, and think about the time that from the time of slavery and emancipation, part of what, when we talked about the race, we really were talking about Black men. There really was a push for this achievement of equal manhood for Black men. And certainly through, I mean, you know the era, the civil rights era. I mean, we know that Black women were told to go to the back and let them, it wasn't really concerned with Black womanhood per se. And so there has been this suppression of Black women and their voices and their strength. It's been co-opted by Black people, too, not just non-Black people.
And you when you write in the chapter about angry Black women, that's also such a loaded term.
and I love the title because I didn't come up with the title yet. It actually came from an Angry Black Woman website. And the title is You Say Angry Like It's a Bad Thing. which I love. And she and I talked and realized that we really were talking about the same image. That when she says angry Black woman and I say strong Black woman, we really are talking about the same thing. And it was Dominique who said, when I am angry, it's not that kind of out of control Black anger. It's like a slow burn. I'm quoting Dominique when I say that. And that really is when Black women, when real Black women talk about being angry. Obviously, they can't go about their life being out of control angry. But there's this, that's where some of the fierceness comes from.
But you want to say something, Dominique?
Yeah, and actually, I try to reserve that serious anger for the bigger issues. I mean, just going into a prison on a weekly basis is enough to make me angry. Mm-hmm. It definitely reawakens a lot of thoughts about slavery, a lot of that memory that's lost, but it's sort of deep down inside of us. And so those things, you know, I do have an anger about that, but I can't afford to be consumed by anger. And generally when it's a person makes me angry, everyone knows my temper. No, actually, I usually try to deal with those things right off the bat. I don't want to carry a lot of anger around. But I think that we, not even just women, I think that African descended folks, we have this memory deep down inside of us about things past, you know, and some of us have anger, some of us have sadness.
I hate to do this, but I was having I was so into this conversation that I didn't even see that we're done. So, Dr. Sherry Parks, dear friend Sherry Parks, thank you so much for writing this book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. Dominique Stevenson, thank you so much for being in the studio with us as well.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. This is wonderful. So we'll have to do some more of this.
Thank you.
Incredible book, folks. You need to read this book and take it to heart and think about it. Good book for people to sit around and talk about together. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back from this very brief break, it's open phones. Time to hear your thoughts on anything you want to talk about in the news, in sports, rant, rave. Join me. We'll be right back.